Hello and welcome to today's call. This is the latest in a series of town hall conference calls ASSA is hosting to address various topics affected with the passage of health care reform. I am Corey Kallheim, senior attorney with ASSA, and I will be one of the presenters and the moderator of today's call. Our call will focus on nursing home transparency, the Elder Justice Act, and fraud, waste, and abuse provisions contained in the health care reform bill. I'm joined today by ASSA Public Policy Attorney Jennifer Hilliard and Maureen Weaver, a partner in the law firm of Wiggin & Dana in New Haven, Connecticut. I will begin by presenting on the nursing home transparency provisions. Jennifer will then cover the Elder Justice Act, and Maureen will follow with the changes in the areas of fraud, waste, and abuse. After our presentations, there will be time for a question and answer session. If you have a question, please email it to townhall@asa.org. This information is provided on slide 27 of your PowerPoint. There is no live questioning, so you must submit your question to townhall@asa.org. In addition to the PowerPoint received, there are materials on the ASSA Health Reform Hub on today's topic, as well as other areas impacted by health care reform. Visit our website at asa.org to explore those resources. Now let's begin with the nursing home transparency provisions. Please turn to slide 4. Now what we call the health care reform bill is actually the combination of two bills. The original Senate bill, which was called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the 2,000-page bill that was passed on March 23, 2010, and the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act of 2010, the 50-page bill passed a week later. Healthcare reform refers to the combination of these bills, or by the acronym of PPACA. So when you hear the term healthcare reform bill or PPACA, they are the same thing and include the combination of those two bills. The nursing home transparency provisions are contained in section 6101 through 6121 of the bill under subtitle B, Nursing Home Transparency and Improvement. The transparency provisions are divided into three parts. The first, improving transparency of information, which is the largest part. The second, targeting enforcement. And the third and small section on improving staff training. As we're on to slide 5, the first section of the improving transparency section is the required disclosure of ownership. This is a section that mandates that nursing homes identify and keep information and records on each member of their governing body, officers, directors, members, managing employees, and additional disclosable parties. This is in addition, the members are currently keeping information on their officers, directors, and some of their managing employees, but this addition of additional disclosable parties is a broad and very big addition. I'm gonna read for you the actual definition straight from the bill because I think it's worth mentioning here. The term additional disclosable party means with respect to a facility or person or entity who exercises operational, financial, or managerial control over the facility or part thereof, or provides policies or procedures for any of the operations of the facility, or provides financial or cash management services. A lease owns a whole or exceeding 5% of the total value of real property, clinical national people involved in organization. So this is a big change. Now, the information must be kept on in the file and it available to the OR Director General, the state officials, or the long-term care ombudsman's offices. Your Form 990 or other public documents that you may have will be sufficient if it has all the available people listed in your Form 990 document. So you can use that to answer a request by one of these groups if it has all your information. So this is kind of the reason this was enacted was because there were some facilities that were using different organizations and different structures to oftentimes to avoid liability issues, but it just expands the disclosable party so people know who actually has an ownership, management, or other interest in the organization. Now, regulations are going to be issued by HHS, and they must do this by March of 2012. And what they're going to do is provide a standardized format for compiling the information. And then facilities must compile and have this information available within 1 year after the issuance of the final regulations. The public will have an opportunity to comment on the proposed regulations. And you're going to notice that as we move along, there's going to be many, many opportunities for people to comment on proposed regulations. The actual health care bill itself was over 2,000 pages, but the regulations that will be promulgated going forward are going to be much, much greater than that. So just keep that in mind. We've only just begun this fight and road and journey. So just stay tuned, and there'll be more to come on this issue. I'm going to pause for just 1 second. We are going to make sure
your conference is now being recorded.
Perfect. I think that now the call is going to be recorded from this point on. So this will be available on the website. If you need to get access to it, it'll be available on the website from here going forward, as well as the materials that are posted. So what should facilities do with regard to the required disclosure of ownership? They should take a look at what they are actually collecting right now, and they are also going to start looking for and see if they have any of those additional disclosable parties, and just start gathering that information ahead of time and be ready for the final regulations and rule when it's promulgated in the next couple of years. Let's turn to slide 6, and we're going to look at perhaps the most important transparency provision for nursing homes in the health care bill, and that's section 6102, which is the accountability requirements for skilled nursing facilities. And what this is under this section, corporate compliance and ethics programs are going to be required of all nursing facilities within 36 months from the date of the enactment of the health care reform bill. So they need to be in place by March 23rd of 2013. This is a big change right now. They're not mandatory. They will be mandatory by 2013. The compliance and ethics programs are designed to prevent and detect criminal, civil, and administrative violations, as well as promote quality of care. The Secretary of HHS will develop regulations, sounds familiar, and identify what needs to be in the plans, and members will obviously have an opportunity to comment, and ASA will as well. The regulations for the compliance and ethics programs must be issued by March 23rd of 2012, so they have about a little less than 2 years to get those regulations out. And what we know so far is what the regulations, they plan to have sponsors with or operators of 5 or more nursing homes are going to have some more formal programs. They will probably include written standards as well as procedures for all of their employees. The additional requirements for the 5 or more nursing home sponsors, those will be spelled out in the regulations, so we'll know a lot more as we move along. So members should actually, what they should do now, they should examine their current compliance plans, if they have one in place, and review the guidance that has previously been published by the Office of Inspector General. In 2000, they issued the Nursing Facility Compliance Program Guidance, and in 2008, they issued a Supplemental Compliance Program Guidance for nursing facilities. So take a look at those two documents, see if your compliance program is in line with the guidance in those documents, and I think you're going to be well on your way to the meeting what's going to come down the road in the regulations as we move forward. The regulations, like I say, are likely to be based on the prior guidance. There's no mandate that they must be, but I think that they're going to be mostly based on that guidance. In ASA and the state associations, we will definitely alert members to any proposed regulations in this area, and we'll be filing comments that we receive from members and our own comments as well. The last bullet on this slide mentions the Quality Assurance and Performance Improvement Program, or the QAPI program. What this is by December 31st of 2011, the Secretary of HHS needs to develop a quality assurance improvement standard and some technical assistance on the development of best practices. That's about all we know on this program so far. Regulations will be issued, and obviously we'll have member comments. These might mirror some of the QAPI programs that are out there right now on other healthcare providers. Next, let's move to slide 7. Another big issue, big section in the nursing home improving the transparency and information is the Nursing Home Compare website. And section 6103 deals with additional information that must be included as we move forward on the Nursing Home Compare website. The biggest area of concern is staffing data. So the staffing data is now going to require resident census and hours per resident per day, as well as staffing turnover and tenure information. And where it gets tricky is according to the health care reform bill, this information must be provided in a format and I'm quoting, that is clearly understandable to consumers of long-term care services and allows consumers to compare staffing differences between facilities as well as state and national averages. Furthermore, the site should also explain how to interpret the data, the differences in the types of staff, relationships between nursing staff levels and quality of care, and an explanation that staffing levels vary based on patient case mix. That is going to be quite an endeavor to get all that information clearly stated on the Nursing Home Compare website. But that's the task that the healthcare reform bill mandates for HHS. In addition, the Nursing Home Compare website is going to include links to state websites that have information on state survey process, as well as possible links to Form 2567s, plans of corrections, or any other documents that that state makes available to the public. It's also going to require a couple other things. First is summary information on the number, type, and severity and outcome of substantiated complaints, and the number of and summaries of adjudicated instances of employee criminal conduct committed and any civil monetary penalties levied as a result of that activity. One other big endeavor that this section has is that the nursing home, or the Secretary of HHS, needs to review the current status of Nursing Home Compare for accuracy, clarity, and timeliness, which is a task in and of itself. HHS has 1 year to consult with stakeholders, which includes provider groups and consumer advocates and their groups, to determine how to improve it and make changes to the site. So that'll be coming within by end of March of next year. And finally, by March of next year, the Nursing Home Compare site must also include a consumer rights information page. This page is supposed to contain information on choosing a nursing facility, consumer rights with respect to nursing facilities, an explanation of the survey process, as well as state-specific information on programs and services through the Ombudsman's Office. The other bullet on this slide involves special focus facility. Although it doesn't necessarily fit in this section, they threw a clause in that provides that any facility that's on a special focus facility list must be surveyed every 6 months. I just think that they didn't have anywhere else to put this, so that's where this clause ended up. So if you're on the special focus facility list, you'll be surveyed once every 6 months. Let's move on now to some additional transparency provisions. On slide 8, you'll see a couple of these mentioned here. The reporting of direct care expenditures, this one's pretty straightforward. This requires HHS to redesign the cost reports so that facilities can separately report expenditures for wages and benefits for direct care staff. HHS has until March of next year to modify the cost report, and facilities will begin using the new cost report in 2012. In addition, by September of 2012, HHS needs to work with MedPAC and MACPAC, Medicare and Medicaid Advisory Commissions, to categorize and come up with summaries of expenditures on direct care, indirect care, capital assets, as well as administrative costs for facilities. As mentioned earlier, HHS also must, and this is going to be on the Nursing Home Compare website as well, HHS has to develop a standardized complaint form for residents or their agents in filing a complaint against the facility. HHS has until March 23rd of next year to develop this form. And in addition to posting that form, making it available on Nursing Home Compare website, the states need to actually establish a complaint resolution process. Some states may have one enacted already, but if they do, they need to comply with the health care reform bill requirements, which include procedures to accurately track complaints, procedures to determine the likely severity of the complaint and investigating it, as well as deadlines for responding and notifying parties of the outcome of the complaint. And the deadline for states on this is March 23rd of next year, so states need to get working on this right away. And finally, on slide 9, we have the last clauses regarding improving transparency. The ensuring staffing accountability, submission of staffing information based on and the 5-star quality rating system. By March 2012, GAO needs to study the star rating system and analyze problems associated with the system and its implementation and how it could be improved. I'm sure we could spend hours talking about our ideas and how the five-star quality rating system can be improved, and hopefully GAO will identify many of the concerns that we have on the five-star rating system and report that to Congress by their deadline in 2012. So I think that's a positive step on the study in the five-star system. Let's move on to targeting enforcement. Section 6111 deals with civil monetary penalties. Under this section, the Secretary of HHS will have the discretion to reduce civil monetary penalties by 50% if the facility self-reports and corrects the deficiency within 10 days of the imposition of the civil monetary penalty. There will be no reduction if they already had a reduction in the previous year. You can't double dip and get two reductions within a year. Or if there's an immediate jeopardy citation, deficiency results in death, or it's a pattern of widespread harm. Another section that's not on this slide deals with the collection of civil monetary penalties. I think this is a positive step too. Secretary of HHS needs to issue regulations that allows the facility to participate in an independent informal dispute resolution process within 30 days of the imposition. It prohibits the imposition of per day penalties during the informal dispute resolution process, but it still allows the collection of the civil monetary penalties and placement into escrow. Now, in cases of successful appeal, the facilities will get their penalty back plus interest, and when the facility does not prevail, the secretary, under their discretion, may allow some of the penalty money to be used to support activities that benefit residents, including joint training, supporting resident and family counsel, implementing quality assurance programs, or the appointment of a temporary management firm if necessary. So once again, HHS, the secretary is going to have a lot of discretion in this area. They will have to promulgate rules and regulations, and those will be available to comment as well, and we'll let every member know when those come out. The next slide on slide 11 addresses the notification of facility closure. Facility administrators must submit written notification of an impending closure 60 days before the facility plans to close to the secretary, ombudsmen, residents, and their legal representatives. No new residents may be admitted after this notification, and the notification must include their plans to relocate and transfer the residents. Administrators who fail to comply with this may be subject to a monetary penalty of up to $100,000 and be excluded from participation in any federal health care program. This requirement goes into effect on March 23rd of next year. So administrators need to be aware of this, and if they're planning on closing a facility, to make sure that they strictly comply with all these obligations. I'm just going to have a quick mention of the last two bullets here on the enforcement. The first bullet, the demonstration projects on culture change in nursing home. These are two 3-year demonstration projects for culture change and information technology. We'll let members know when the application process is published and work with members to provide assistance if they're interested in applying for these projects. We did a call on demonstrations last week, and the audio and materials from that call are available on our website. The National Independent Monitor demonstration, that pertains to interstate and large intrastate change that have had ongoing problems of quality and safety issues, and so that's a demonstration project that helped those chains. Finally, the next slide, as I mentioned, the improved staff training. That's just a short section that deals with dementia and abuse prevention training for nurse aides. It actually amends the nurse aid training requirement to include dementia training and patient abuse. And at the same time, it also clarifies the definition of nurse aid to include agency or contract staff. So the effective date of this is March 23rd of next year. So if you currently have a program on nurse aid training, take a look at what you have and make sure that you include dementia management and abuse prevention, and that includes your agency or contract staff in that training. And look for any other additional regulations that CMS may issue regarding this section. So before I turn over to Jennifer, I just want to mention that all of these materials will be on our Health Reform Hub. So if you visited ASA.org and then click on the Health Reform Hub, you'll find all these different materials, including this PowerPoint. So at this time, I'm going to turn over to Jennifer, and she'll take you through the Elder Justice Act provisions.
Thank you, Corey, and good afternoon, everyone. Beginning on slide 13, we'll examine the elder justice provisions of the health care reform law. The elder justice provisions got their start in separate legislation that was making its way through Congress and was folded into the health care reform legislation. The provisions can be found at Subtitle H of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The Elder Justice provisions actually amend the Title 20 of the Social Security Act, which is the Social Services Block Grant Program. While the Elder Justice provisions are largely concerned with understanding and providing an infrastructure for handling instances of elder abuse and neglect, there are some very important reporting requirements that must be followed by individuals working in the long-term care environment. These reporting requirements apply to all long-term care facilities that receive at least $10,000 in federal funding. The definition of long-term care facility makes clear that both nursing facilities and assisted living facilities are included. What isn't clear, however, is whether the independent living portion of a CCRC would be included. That would depend on whether the entire CCRC campus is considered a long-term care facility by the fact that there is a nursing and/or assisted living component present. Also, because the federal funding threshold of $10,000 is so low, unless the facility is entirely private pay, the elder justice reporting requirements will be found to apply. Moving to slide 14, let's examine the specifics of the elder justice reporting requirements. Okay, who within a long-term care facility is obligated to report? Well, the answer to that is pretty much everyone. The reporting requirements apply to covered individuals. That term is defined to mean an owner, operator, employee, manager, agent, or contractor of the long-term care facility. As a result, to the extent that the facility uses contract nursing or other staff, these individuals will need to be notified regarding their obligations under the Elder Justice provisions. The healthcare reform law requires that such notification be performed annually by the owner of the facility. Also, it would seem that a single event could trigger multiple obligations to report. For example, if a nurse discovers suspicious bruises on a resident, not only is the nurse required to report the bruises, but the facility owner would be obligated to report the bruises as well. When is the reporting obligation triggered? The obligation to report is triggered when the covered individuals form a reasonable suspicion that a crime against a resident has occurred. While other provisions of the law define and discuss elder abuse and neglect, the reporting requirement speaks only of a reasonable suspicion of a crime as defined by the jurisdiction in which the facility is located. Thus, the reporting requirements would seem to apply to a broader range of acts or omissions. Next, what are the deadlines for reporting? In cases where the act or omission has caused serious bodily injury to the resident, the covered individual is required to report within 2 hours after forming the reasonable suspicion that a crime has occurred. In all other cases, reporting within 24 hours is required. Finally, to whom must the report be made? Well, the provisions require reporting to the Secretary of HHS and one or more law enforcement entities within the political subdivision in which the facility is located. This could be construed to mean reporting to the local police, the long-term care ombudsman, and the state survey agency. We will be waiting for regulations to find out if that is actually the case. On slide 15, the penalties for failure of covered individuals to comply with the reporting requirements. In most cases, the covered individual can be assessed a civil monetary penalty of up to $200,000 and can be excluded from participation in federal health care programs. In cases where the failure to report exacerbates harm to the victim or results in harm to another individual, the covered individual can be assessed a CMP of up to $300,000 and faces possible exclusion from participation. A good example of this is where suspicious bruises are not reported and the following day the resident is discovered to have been further beaten. That would qualify for the higher CMPs. Again, the law could be construed to call for multiple penalties stemming from a single incident that goes unreported by both facility staff and facility management. As I pointed out, there is a lot of ambiguity in the reporting requirements. We hope that much of this ambiguity will be resolved when regulations are promulgated by HHS. In the interim, however, we encourage our members to be proactive in training their staff of the requirements and contact enforcers to seek their input. Moving to slide 16, the elder justice provisions specify that a long-term care facility or failure to comply with the elder justice reporting requirement is ineligible to receive federal program. Reporting requirements by a staff actually causes the facility to be ineligible for SSBG funds, even if the facility fires the individual upon learning of the reporting violation, hopefully will be addressed by regulations. There is an exception to this provision for extenuating circumstances, which are defined as financial burdens posed by underserved populations. The statute describes three specific underserved populations. Those are geographically isolated populations, i.e. rural facilities, racial and ethnic minority populations, and special needs populations. The two latter cases will need to be further fleshed out in the regulations. The elder justice reporting requirements contain provisions that protect covered individuals who report suspected crimes against residents from retaliation by the long-term care facility. Any facility that is found to have engaged in retaliation is subject to a civil monetary penalty of up to $300,000 and, turning to the top of slide 17, possible exclusion from participation in federal health care programs for a period of 2 years. A notice informing employees of their rights regarding protection from retaliation is required to be displayed in a conspicuous location of the facility. The exact contents of the notice, however, will be specified by the regulation when it comes out. Finally, the elder justice provisions call for studies to examine the establishment of a national nurse aid registry. They also provide funding for various opportunities and establish the administrative and forensic framework for dealing with cases of elder abuse and neglect. That's pretty much it for the elder justice provisions. They're fairly straightforward. There are a lot of commissions and regulatory bodies that will be formed as a result of this, like I said, a lot remains to be dealt with in the regulations. I will now turn the program over to Maureen Weaver, who will discuss the fraud and abuse provisions of the health care reform law.
Thank you, Jennifer, and good afternoon, everyone. Turning now to slide 18. The healthcare reform law contains numerous provisions dedicated to boosting program integrity in the federal healthcare programs. And of course, as we know, fighting fraud, waste, and abuse in healthcare is an important initiative, has been an important initiative for any president, and it's been very important to the Obama administration. Now, thanks to the healthcare reform law, $10 million per year over the next 10 years have been added to the healthcare fraud and abuse control account. And then another $250 million for the next 5 years was appropriated under the reconciliation law that Corey mentioned earlier that makes up part of the healthcare reform law. Aside from this funding infusion, the healthcare reform law casts a broad net to extend federal and state authority to combat fraud, waste, and abuse in Medicare and Medicaid. Over the next few minutes, I'd like to provide you with a sampling of the key fraud, waste, and abuse provisions that we believe will be of most interest to ASA members. Let's turn now to slide number 19. And the first topic that I would like to discuss is overpayments and the requirement under Section 6402 of the Healthcare Reform Law that any overpayment must be reported and returned to the appropriate government authority within certain specified time frames. Now, any ethical organization would agree that if it has been paid too much by a payer, whether that payer is government payer, an insurer, or a patient, it shouldn't keep the money and should return it to its rightful owner. You may find it hard to believe that up until the enactment of the healthcare reform law, there was no really clear legal requirement that under Medicare and Medicaid about when, how, or even definitively whether overpayments must be repaid. This new overpayment provision applies to all Medicare and Medicaid participating providers, suppliers, Medicaid managed care organizations, and Medicare Advantage organizations. And so it applies to most ASA members, all ASA members who receive Medicare or Medicaid payments. In particular, the provision requires that you must report and return an overpayment to the appropriate government authority or contractor no later than 60 days after the date the overpayment is identified or the date any corresponding cost report is due, if applicable. And please note that this provision is currently in effect. It took effect on March 23rd when President Obama signed it into law. Now, most Medicare contractors and many Medicaid programs have formal processes and forms and procedures in place for returning overpayments. I know that for our region, National Government Services has a specific form that you can complete that walks you through the information that the contractor requires when you return an overpayment and gives you instructions for how to make out the check and where to send it. And so for those of you who are looking at compliance with this provision, you ought to look into your local rules for your local MAC and look at your state Medicaid program to see what procedures are in place. Now, although this provision of PACA regarding overpayments was enacted to create some bright line rules about when you need to return them, it's really raised many questions. For example, what does it mean to identify an overpayment, which would then trigger your 60-day timeframe for returning the overpayment? Is it after you've fully quantified the amount? Is it when you first discover it and before you calculate it? I can't tell you how many times I've run into situations where I've received calls from clients who said they believe that they discovered an overpayment or a billing error, and then we get into it further and investigate and review information and talk to people and find out that there really wasn't an overpayment. And so it's really not clear how much time you have to conduct that full investigation, but it's safe to assume that you ought to be prepared to report investigate, report, and return it within 60 days. It's also unclear that if you file a cost report, and of course most nursing homes do for Medicaid and all do for Medicare, what happens if you don't discover the overpayment until after the cost report is filed? Presumably you still have the opportunity and the government would be happy to take back your money after that period of time, but it's unclear whether the 60-day time frame would apply or whether you could wait until the next cost report is filed. One significant aspect of the new overpayment return requirement is that Section 6402 now provides that any failure to meet the overpayment obligation could lead to a False Claims Act liability. And because this is such a significant development, I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about the False Claims Act, and that brings us to slide 20. As some of you may know, the False Claims Act is a very old Civil War era law. It applies to any contractor, and it calls for civil liability if you knowingly present a false or fraudulent claim for government payment or approval, or make a false record or statement material to a false or fraudulent claim. Liability can lead to treble damages, and in an overpayment situation, that would be three times the amount of the overpayment, plus the potential for an additional $5,500 to $11,000 per violation. Now, two important points about the False Claims Act. First of all, the False Claims Act can be brought by a whistleblower or a key TAM relator, the Latin term for a whistleblower, which is cited in the law. Basically, what happens is that the whistleblower files a complaint under seal with federal court. The U.S. Attorney's Office for that district investigates and can make one of two decisions. Either the U.S. Attorney's Office will choose to prosecute the claim on its own, or they will decline. If they decline, the whistleblower can still prosecute the action on his or her own. The whistleblower gets a cut, a percentage, of whatever is recovered, whether it's recovered going through a full trial or through a settlement. Obviously, the whistleblower will get more of a cut if he or she ends up prosecuting the case on his or her own. The second point about the False Claims Act is that you're not automatically liable under the False Claims Act just because the claim you present is inaccurate due to an innocent mistake. You're only liable if you knew or should have known that the claim was false. This has been further defined as meaning that you acted with quote-unquote reckless disregard or quote-unquote in deliberate ignorance. Now, let's take the overpayment example. If you missed the 60-day deadline because you were making a good faith attempt to finalize your calculations, you got a little bit delayed because there were some issues involved, but you did get your report in within a few weeks, I would argue that there should not be False Claims Act liability because there was no reckless disregard. There was a good faith attempt to comply. But I believe the government would argue, and I've heard some regulators state this since the health care reform law and this provision was enacted, that if, let's say, one of your employees were to report a problem with a potential overpayment, let's say there was a problem with rug coating that could result in payment, and you believe that the natural conclusion would be that you would have been overpaid, do nothing at all. You did on it. You keep deferring and deferring, and maybe finally a year later you get around to returning the over. You don't do anything where the government is now finding false liability. Healthcare revision of things that builds on prior efforts to broaden the False Claims Act's reach. Just about a year ago in 2009, Congress passed the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act, otherwise known as FERA. Before FERA, you were only liable under the False Claims Act if you did something affirmative. You submitted a false claim, for example, or you made a false statement. FERA holds that it's not necessary for you to make an affirmative act, and if you do hold on to funds owed back to the government, for example, or fail to return them, you could be held liable under the False Claims Act. This has become known among prosecutors and others who work in this area as the reverse false claims provision. So if you're thinking you might be able to get away with liability for False Claims Act violations because you don't go looking for problems, for example, you don't identify an overpayment, thus triggering your obligation to return it, you need to think twice, because the government could assert False Claims Act liability if you look the other way and fail to detect and repay overpayments when you knew or should have known that they were there to be analyzed and reviewed and calculated and repaid to the government. Now, let's go on to slide number 22, and I want to make one last point relating to the False Claims Act. Just to note that the healthcare reform law also made changes in the False Claims Act that make it easier for whistleblowers to bring and maintain claims. I noted them here. They involve a weakening of the public disclosure bar. A whistleblower can't bring a claim if it's based on information that's already out in the public domain, and also a modification or actually a broadening of the requirement that the whistleblower be the original source of a claim. And I'd like to pause for a minute and just make a few comments based on my practice and my experience representing providers in investigations under the False Claims Act. The False Claims Act really has become the federal government's most significant healthcare enforcement tool. The government also has an arsenal of criminal laws that it can use in these situations, but it's far more common to see claims filed or settlements made under the False Claims Act, obviously because there's a much lower burden of proof for the government. You must be aware, I would imagine, over the last few years that there have been a number of court cases and settlements that have come out where the government has used the False Claims Act to go after nursing homes that have been, that allegedly have provided very poor substandard quality of care. Another use of the False Claims Act that we've seen here in our own backyard in Connecticut is the use of the False Claims Act to go after providers that fail to check the OIG's exclusion database and inadvertently employed individuals who have been excluded from the Medicare or Medicaid programs. in all of these cases, and there have been a few in our state, the government, these cases were all settled as violations of the False Claims Act. We are also seeing more and more whistleblower claims, and it's not like the government goes looking for many of these cases. They almost have to proceed in some cases because the claim is brought to their attention by a whistleblower. And whistleblowers can come from anywhere. Many times they're former employees. Many times they're former employees. I settled a case 2 years ago involving a former employee whistleblower. In some cases, they might may be physicians. There's a case that was recently settled involving Rush Memorial in Chicago, where one of the whistleblowers was a physician, and when you read the complaint that was filed, you could see that even after he had filed the complaint with the government under seal, the hospital had no idea that it was under investigation, but as you could see in the complaint, it was amended later, and you could see that the doctor was going back and forth and getting statements from nurses and then using that in their allegations against the hospital and the complaint. We also have professional whistleblowers out there, and there are stories of professional whistleblowers, stories of nurses, for example, who will become employed as a director of nursing in one state and blow the whistle and then move on to another state. There was also a story of one whistleblower who just happened to be a used car salesman and came across some information from a friend or a contact and ended up bringing down an organization and making lots and lots of money after a False Claims Act case was filed against a provider. So something to be concerned about, and this can affect any range of organizations. It's big organizations, and we've seen very small providers affected. And the unfortunate situation is that when the claim is filed, the government has to conduct some investigation. They typically issue a subpoena. Subpoena can call for records, but they want to see not only your paper records, they want to see all your emails and electronic records, and producing all of that information can become quite costly. So what is your best defense here? Your best defense is to have an effective compliance program on the front end to make sure that you have an atmosphere of openness within the organization and a process for any potential whistleblower to complain to you first so the problem can get resolved then and there. It's also important on the back end to regularly audit so that you can detect problems and you can take the initiative and be proactive and report them and return money to the government. If you do have an effective compliance program in place and you are one of those unfortunate situations where there is a False Claims Act filed by a claim filed by the government or by a whistleblower, you can use that compliance program, the strength of your compliance program, to help considerably mitigate the case against you and the amount of fines or damages that you may need to pay back. Now let's turn to slide 23. And to another significant component of the healthcare reform integrity package, and that is provider screening. These provisions are set forth in section 6401 of the healthcare reform law. As you may know, there's been much concern about the real fraud that has gone on in the, say, the home care industry. We've heard stories of phony home care agencies that have been established and built Medicare and Medicaid through fraudulent billings, and that I think Miami unfortunately gets tagged for that type of activity, but it's apparently happened in other locations as well, and the Obama administration is really clamping down on that through its HEAT task force involving HHS and OIG. But and I think much of that is behind these provisions to really, really enhance provider screening. The healthcare reform law contains provisions that tighten up screening before enrollment and also expand oversight of new providers. Section 6401 requires HHS to promulgate regulations outlining the level of screening that must be done before enrollment. And that screening must include licensure checks. It could include licensure checks in multiple states. And it may include criminal background checks, fingerprinting, and in some cases, unscheduled visits. Those regulations are due 180 days from the date of enactment, which I calculate to be sometime in September. And then there's a deadline. The deadline for new providers will be March 2011. It also applies, these screening requirements will also apply to current providers when they re-enroll starting in March 2012. The oversight of new providers that I mentioned will also be detailed further in HHS regulations, but Section 6401 provides that oversight must include 30 days to a year probationary period and may include subjecting the provider to prepayment reviews. Also effective March 2011, new enrollees must disclose any current or former affiliation with any provider or supplier that has an uncollected debt, been subject to payment suspensions, been excluded from the federal health care program, or had billing privileges revoked. HHS also has the discretion to deny enrollment if it believes that enrollment will heighten the risk of fraud, waste, and abuse, and that's a very general authority delegated to HHS. Finally, Section 6401 permits HHS to make adjustments to payments due to one provider if a provider with the same tax ID number has past due obligations, even if that provider that owes the government money has a different NPI number. Now, although I did not list this provision on slide number 23, I do want to note that there's a separate provision of the health care reform law that authorizes HHS to exclude from Medicaid participation any individual that owns, manages, or controls an entity that has delinquent overpayments. So you see they mean business on the overpayment theme here, and that's in section 6502. Turning now to slide number 24. As another potent tool to bolster the fight against fraud, waste, and abuse, the healthcare reform law expands the OIG's civil monetary penalty authority through Section 6402 and 6408. We talked before about the False Claims Act, which is primarily administered by the Department of Justice. The Office of Inspector General has separate administrative authority, and as you know, the OIG can exclude providers and suppliers from federal healthcare programs, but it can also issue fines. The healthcare reform law has expanded the OIG's authority to fine to include several types of situations that are listed in slide number 24. For example, once again, overpayments. You know of an overpayment and do not return it within the time frames. Also, when there have been orders prescribed by an individual when excluded from. Now, I do want to note there's one correction on this slide. On the last bullet point, there was some text missing, and that should read a situation where someone knowingly makes, uses, or causes to be made or used a false fraudulent claim under a federal health care program. Finally, monetary penalties are available when granted access to the OIG for audits, or investigate. Related point, I want to, there's another reform law, which is in section 6408C, which is in effect now, that gives the HHS permissive exclusion authority over any provider or supplier that obstructs an investigation or program audit. Turning now to slide number 25, which discusses the health care reform law's changes concerning anti-kickback statute and the Stark law. The anti-kickback statute applies when any person knowingly offers to make or makes payments in exchange for referrals of items or services covered by Medicare or Medicaid. It also applies to someone who receives payments under those circumstances or demands payments under those circumstances. This is a criminal statute. It's serious business. It could result in fines and imprisonment. The health care reform law contains two provisions affecting the anti-kickback statute. First, remember that I said the anti-kickback statute applies if you knowingly offer or receive payments in exchange for referrals? Well, the health care reform law makes it clear that you need not have actual knowledge of the law or a specific intent to violate it. In other words, ignorance of the law is no excuse here. Second, the health care reform law provides that a violation, an anti-kickback statute violation, will be considered a False Claims Act offense. This means that the government can prosecute an individual or an organization on the criminal side for a False Claims Act violation, but in a parallel track, they can also prosecute them on the civil side and aim to recover hefty damages for False Claims Act violations. At this point, you're probably wondering when we're going to report on something positive that Congress did through these provisions. Well, many of us do view this next one step as a positive step, and that is the requirement that HHS establish in 6 months a self-disclosure protocol for STARK Act violations. STARK is the law that prohibits payments for certain designated health services referred by a physician who has a financial relationship with a provider. It's a very complicated law with many exceptions that are incredibly technical and have been subject to much debate and change and flip-flopping back and forth over time. Many providers have found in retrospect that they've had arrangements that did not comply with the letter of the STARK law. It's got strict liability provision, and so these providers wanted an opportunity to report and rectify the situation. So this new self-disclosure referral protocol will give them the opportunity. It also provides, the healthcare reform law also provides that HHS may reduce amounts owed by a provider making a self-disclosure based on the nature and extent of the practice, the timeliness in making the report, and the provider's cooperation in providing any additional information. And now for our last slide, which is slide number 26. Here we wanted to alert you to one change that affects all Medicare providers. Section 6402 now requires that you must submit Medicare claims within 1 year of the date of service. This provision applies to all services furnished on or after January 1st of 2010. And this is a major change because now under, well, not now, it's now in effect, but under prior law, you had 3 years to file a claim. I also wanted to mention the RACs, the recovery audit contractors, because many of you do receive significant revenues from state Medicaid programs. And under Section 6411 of the Healthcare Reform Law, Congress has now required that all state Medicaid programs enter into contracts with recovery audit contractors to perform the same types of functions for Medicaid that they are currently providing for Medicare. We've now concluded the formal part of our presentation, and I'm going to turn it back to Corey for questions.
Thank you, Maureen. Right now we're going to do the questions and the answers session, and we've got some questions that came in prior to the session, as well as some questions that came in during the session. The first question actually revolves around some elder justice provisions. The question is, if the state does not pay for assisted living care, but they receive payment from residents with no personal funds through the SSI program, does that constitute federal funds? And so I'll turn this question over to Jennifer.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Although the regulations undoubtedly will address the types of federal funds that qualify a facility for elder justice obligations, I would argue in this case that personal SSI funds do not count because they're not paid directly to the facility by the government. Rather, they're paid to the resident who then pays them to the facility. So on that basis, I would make the argument that they don't count. Now, that said, we don't know what the regulations are going to say, and I do know that the congressional intent for this law is for it to apply broadly. So we shall see.
Thanks, Jennifer. The second question that I have actually is on the elder justice provisions as well, so I'll have Jennifer answer this. It's a two-part question. When do the Healthcare Reform Elder Justice Act provisions go into effect? And where did the initial Elder Justice Act provisions originate?
Well, the Elder Justice provisions are in effect now. They became effective when the legislation was signed into law in March. I don't think that any of the violations are going to be enforced yet because there are no regulations that would enable agencies to go ahead and do that. However, you know, again, it's supposed to apply broadly and everyone should be, you know, trying to prevent elder abuse. The second part of the question is the Elder Justice Act was based on Senate Bill 1070 and House Bill 1783, which were introduced in the 110th Congress back in 2007, 2008. H.R. 1783 was referred to Ways and Means, Judiciary, looks like Energy and Commerce, and Education and Labor, but it was marked up and passed out of the Judiciary Committee only. As for the Senate bill, it was marked up and passed by the Senate Finance Committee in 2008, but was never voted on by the Senate. So these provisions got all rolled into the greater health reform bill. I realize that all the numbers are kind of confusing, but and it's more kind of inside the Beltway gobbledygook more than anything else, because now they are a matter of law.
Thanks, Jennifer. The next question actually deals with compliance plans. The question is this. We're starting out, one of our goals for our organization is to improve our compliance plan, which we admit is not very robust. With the new healthcare reform requirements that require compliance plans be in place within 36 months, what should we do at this point? Well, it's true that the mandatory compliance and ethics programs will not be mandated until 36 months from now, so in March of 2013. However, I would continue to improve on your compliance program as much as you can before you get to that point. And I think the starting off point, which if you haven't already looked at the documents, are the 2000 and 2008 OIG guidance. I think the proposed regulations that are going to come out are going to be significantly based on the guidance that these two documents have. And then I would just start out your process now, and then I think you'll be well on your way. Also, just keep in mind the proposed regulations that will come out. They need to come out within the next 2 years, so those will certainly provide some additional guidance as you go along. So that's where I would start right there. There's nothing that says you can't take off on the compliance project before, sooner rather than later. So that's what I would do. The next question is back on elder justice provisions. The question is, how do the elder justice reporting requirements mesh with any existing state reporting requirements regarding elder abuse and neglect?
Okay. I would argue, again, we're going to need to see what the regulations have to say, but I would say that to the extent that the elder justice provisions are more stringent than the state reporting requirements, that the elder justice provisions would preempt the state. But my guess is that there will probably be some effort to enmesh both of them together so they work together rather than at odds with each other.
Thanks, Jennifer. The next question actually is for Maureen, and it's a compound question regarding overpayments. So Maureen, here's the question. I understand we now need to pay back overpayments that we identify, but do these changes also mean that we have an obligation to make sure the facility has not received any overpayments? What if we received an overpayment but we didn't know about it? Are we at risk if we fail to identify it?
Well, Corey, I think the answer to that question really depends on the situation here. At the outset, what I would say is that, as we discussed earlier, under FARA, which is 2009 amendments to the False Claims Act, Congress made it clear that you could be held to the Claims Act for failure to earn overpayment. Have to make affirmative actual statement. If you hold on to the government's months of time, be found liable. Now, what happens if you didn't know about it? Sometimes the excuse is it may be usable.